Nine, Harvey.
I get to take the hot seat. Christine's gonna queue up our, do you wanna stay?
I'll stay.
You can stay. I'll sit on this side, then I can pop up.
You're not gonna be blocking the slide?
No, I'm afraid I'll be sitting in front of this.
No, you won't.
Did anyone?
I'll see.
Yeah, have a seat.
To you, anyone told me.
I mean that in the tight sense.
Don't repeat that.
Can you see?
Oh, no, that's the January meeting.
Yeah.
Did we lose our colleagues in Torrey Pines?
We did.
I can't imagine why.
What's that all about?
They were brokenhearted.
Especially since we paid for the room, right?
You paid for the room.
Is that room all there?
Okay, annually, I get the pleasure of talking with you about different fiduciary things, and so that's what this is all about. In the backup materials I gave you, I kind of gave you, again, as I have in the past, sort of the core fiduciary responsibilities. Now, why don't you look at those ahead of time, because I want you to use that as kind of a checklist. You know that first page that kind of looks so, first two pages that looks like that? I don't know what they are in the materials. Put that off to one side for right now. It is very difficult, and I'm glad we had a conversation about specific things, you know, with the Brown Act. It's tough to talk about things like the law and fiduciary responsibilities in a vacuum. And so what I really wanted to do this time with you is a little more interactive and try to give you some real-life scenarios. And these are, I picked five events that have actually taken place elsewhere, not here, that I want to go over with you. And I want to give you an opportunity to kind of spot the issues and look at some of those things that appear in the material so that you see, in a real sense, how do we apply some of these conflict of interest issues? How do we apply these fiduciary standards? I will always come back. Let's see. I'll make sure. Great. I will. This is the lawyer's version, the fiduciary counsel's version of Paul Angelo's CI equals B plus E, right? This is my Bible for you. These are the core fiduciary responsibilities that we will always come back to, and let me just highlight briefly before we get into some of the scenarios I want to talk about. Exclusive benefit rule, and these are all out of the Constitution, and even without the state constitution, these were written in trust law. You're all trustees. This was written in trust law for a couple hundred years. Exclusive benefit rule is trustees, you're obligated to use the assets of the system solely to pay the benefits that are owed to members and beneficiaries and reasonable expenses of administration. This is a rule that triggers all those conflicts of interest issues, avoiding undue influence, people leaning on you to vote in a certain way, avoiding serving other purposes. These are things like where we get into even discussions about environmental and social issues that may have good reasons to use the assets for or not for, divestment issues, for example. Should we not invest in tobacco, for example? It comes up, goes back to the exclusive benefit rule. Are you using the assets of the system solely to pay benefits, or are you trying to accomplish some other purpose with the assets? So that's what gets triggered by that. The next rule, the primary loyalty rule, is in all the responsibilities that you have, your first and primary responsibility are to the members of the system, retired members, deferred members, active members, future members. That's your first and foremost obligation. That also is what triggers all these rules that we have about conflicts of interest, for example. You can't come in here and serve somebody else's interest and be an appropriate fiduciary. your job is for the members. The standard by which you're measured is the prudent expert standard, but not the prudent person standard. It's a higher standard. It means that you're to exercise your judgment. We had a good example of the exercise of judgment today on one of our agenda items over pensionability and enhancements. The prudent expert standard means that you can't simply be well-intentioned. You have to educate yourself. And if you don't have a level of education on something, you have to go out and get it. That's why you hire consultants. That's why you hire people to come in and help you with all the arcane things that we need to deal with. Today, you did that. Today, you went out and got a lot of information on the issue that was in front of you. That's being prudent. That's a prudent expert in making a decision. And that's that. So that goes to the process you follow, the due process that you engage in before you can make a collective decision. And finally, as a trustee, you have to follow the law. We got a lot of laws. Lord knows we have an awful lot of laws that apply to us. Brown Act's a perfect example. There's nothing in the Constitution that says you have to obey the Brown Act, but you have to obey the Brown Act. You have to obey the Internal Revenue Code to maintain the tax-qualified status of the plan. That's just another one of the laws that you have to follow. So we're here to help you follow the law, but that is one of the fundamental fiduciary responsibilities. How do you put that all into practice? I'm going to go over some scenarios. I intentionally did not give you these ahead of time because I wanted you to do a little homework. And if you promise not to read and jump ahead, I will circulate them to you because I'd like you to take notes.
I can do it.
Okay. I'd like you to take notes as we come to each scenario as to what things strike your mind. But this is where you get to pitch in as board members. And we'll go through some of these scenarios. We'll try to do it quickly because I'd like to get through all of them. Each one highlights something different. Wait until we get the scenario on the screen, if you would, before you cheat and look ahead. Because the surprise factor is important. Anyway, let's go to the first one as soon as the last thing's handed out there. Let's go to our first scenario. As I say, these, with a little bit of tweaking in some of the facts, not much, these are true stories. Scenario number one, okay? Follow with me here. Board member Charlie is a retiree who has a gemology degree. When he attends SACRS and other conferences, he likes to host a late-night sales auction in his hotel room, where he auctions off gems and jewelry to the highest bidder. Now, parenthetically, I would tell you, I changed where the location of the conference was, but not the facts. Okay? The winning bidders, turns out, are usually personnel of investment managers who can afford the $1,000 plus prices that he gets on the auctions. Just so happens, earlier on the day of one particular auction, the firm of one of the successful bidders, the money managers who's at the auction, the firm responded to an open RFP from Charlie's system. Any issues, Mr. Chairman?
The big red flag.
Which is what?
Well, now it creates a scenario where if this firm, may be thinking, I need to participate in this this bidding for the gyms, or else I may be looked upon unfavorably by the trustee. And from the trustee's standpoint, I mean, it holds true in reverse, that now he's putting himself in a situation where I don't know if they're buying my $1,000 pieces because they really like these gems, or They're trying to influence me. So now when it come, when assuming this RFP comes before the board or somehow, he could be compromised and have to recuse himself.
Should he vote on that if it comes before the board?
I would think not. He's compromised both ways, because even if they don't participate, now it's going to have the appearance, oh, geez, if you had come to my little gym show, maybe I would have been in a better position to be successful in the RFP.
So you're concerned about it, there being a perception that it's not a level playing field when they issue an RFP?
Yes.
Where does that, what is the requirement that there be a level playing field?
Primary loyalty.
What's that?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, you get to talk. Well, he gets a speaking role today.
Sure.
It violates the primary loyalty rule.
Why?
You're supposed to be acting for the sole benefit of the plan, and you're, in this case, acting in your own benefit.
Why is this contrary to the plan's interests?
Right.
It's a totally, it's private, up in his hotel room. He's, you know, what do you care?
Because that trustee is gaining from his relationship, personally gaining from his relationship in a manner in which no other person is gaining.
So he's accepting a gift?
Yes.
Well, he's giving something in exchange.
Regardless, he's accepting a gift.
You think he has to disclose it on his Form 700?
He has to not do it, for starters.
Everybody else agree with it? Rusty?
Well, I think, again, in this case, his judgment will be bogged or affected because he may feel he owes to this bidder who may have bought a gem the night before. And I also question whether or not he could even have held this event in his hotel room at Sackers, which has been paid for by, you know,
good point.
Pension. So,
so he's taking advantage of something that's been paid for by his system as part of the business of the system,
right,
and getting personal gain out of it.
His exclusive.
And if there's an RFP going on, certainly he should have blocked out anybody to this party of his that were part of that RFP. He shouldn't have been involved. He should not have made any contact himself.
If he's giving something of value in return for the cash he's getting, does anybody have a problem?
Yeah, I was going to say, as a minimum, there's a profit. Now, the profit may be $900 out of that $1,000 that he sold the gem for. So is there a gift component? Maybe it's full fair market value, but as a practical matter, there's going to be a profit in it for him to sell it. Should he put himself in that kind of position dealing with somebody that the trust hires? I would categorically say no.
So does it matter whether there was an open, let's suppose there wasn't an open RFP at the time this auction took place. Would that matter to you?
Is the investment manager already serving?
No, somebody out of left field.
No relationship at all?
No relationship at all. A prospect, of course, you know, managers are always prospective.
I suppose the prospect would come up if I say it would certainly matter less. But any time in the future that manager was proposing, I would think he would have to, as a minimum, fully describe what had taken place and probably recuse himself.
John raises a very good point, and that is as much a fiduciary responsibility you owe to each other as you owe to your members in terms of being prudent, and that is disclosure. A really critical point there. If Todd were the trustee who did this, and you know the other trustees didn't know about it, and then they went out to an RFP, and one of the bidders was this company,
Wouldn't you, as board members, want to know before you consider that person, that firm, that one of your colleagues who's going to be voting on that had this relationship or tie-in or something like that? You would owe it to each other to make that disclosure, and I think you would expect it from each other to have that disclosure made so that you knew that each one of you were exercising your independent judgment and not tainted or even the appearance of taint. Part of the issue here is this appearance thing. I mean, maybe if Charlie put a price tag, you know, had a table out and put it, said, this particular necklace is $1,000 and this one's $1,200 instead of an auction. I don't even know if that would help you think that that makes it any bit better. But once, you know, the story is about an auction and people bidding at each other over a value price, an asking price, so you get into your profit.
Yep.
There's clearly a profit there. Now you've got one of your board members profiting by somebody who's going to do business with the board.
You know. So it's self-dealing, right?
What's that?
He's self-dealing. He's doing something under the guise of being a trustee for his own personal benefit, and that goes against the primary loyalty rule because he's looking more at the relationship between him and the investment manager.
Right.
May decide to go with that with the RFP instead of thinking, is this the best decision for our beneficiaries?
Is there anything wrong with self-dealing when it's after hours?
As long as it's secret, as long as no one knows, it's okay.
Well, I mean, I think that that's one of the other points, too, is that you mentioned jewelry. And so if there was an RFP and maybe the finalist was the high bidder or something, and they come to the board meeting
and
that individual is actually wearing it, and everyone knows, oh, that's his stuff. I mean, that, you know. I mean, they shouldn't be doing this anyway, but, you know.
I recognize Charlie's design. Good.
And well, Charlie's using his position, too, as a board member to get his clientele.
Yeah.
Yes, he is.
I mean, he's...
Yes, he is. Would anyone come to Charlie's hotel room...
He wasn't
a
trustee
on the board.
Yeah.
Maybe OJ.
Probably not.
That's true. Good point.
Okay, how about let's move from that and try scenario number two. All right, you're allowed to look at scenario number two now. Different approach here. Okay, we have an unfunded liability in a Searle system. Big surprise, right? The UAAL and the Searle system is attributed entirely to benefits earned by legacy employees. I should carry it in there. I mean retired and active legacy employees. Okay, the past. There is no PEPRA unfunded liability. The county says you're killing us. The high contributions are squeezing out services it can provide. So a board member moves that the board extend the amortization period from 17 years to 30 years, level percent of pay, to ease the county's burden. That'll bring the contribution rates down for the county. So at the board meeting, legacy members come in, active members, and they come in and push for the change. They say, this is great. We want you to extend the amortization because it will help us get salary increases. PEPRA members come to the board meeting and argue that their ability to get future salary increases will be harmed because the county will still be paying off this unfunded liability long into their years of service and so and long after the current legacy members retire. So you've got one bunch of members who are arguing, do this, change the amortization, ease the burden on the county. Another set of members that say, don't do it, it will be paying this long into the future. What are your trustees going to do? David, take a shot at it.
Your first loyalty is to making sure the system is sustainable and healthy going forward. You're able to take into consideration the sponsor and what stresses they may be under. But you don't have that loyalty to the sponsor. You don't have to act to protect the sponsor, but you can take that into consideration. You have to ignore arguments from Legacy and Pepper employees about what stresses they're under now or in the future. The main focus is how do we keep the system going and stable going forward. And if taking into account the stress of the sponsor and how does that fit into that scenario, then you consider that too.
Now, Paul Angelo would tell you, don't worry about the amortization period, right? It's, you're going to end up paying it off the funded liability anyway. It's just a matter of timing. So do you care whether it's a 30-year amortization or not?
Well, yeah, I do. Because beyond 18 or beyond 20, you have a negative amortization.
That's right. I want to make sure. Yeah. But over 18, we very clearly dealt with that here. And using a level percent of salary as the salary base,
right,
as the basis for determining the contribution amount, just the interplay of the numbers are that the curve keeps going up. In other words, the unfunded keeps getting larger until you get a number of years out before it begins to come down. Using a fixed dollar amount, that wouldn't happen, but you would in the way it's being described. So is allowing that unfunded liability to go up substantially meet that test of sustainability and what is best for the membership of the plan? And we very clearly come to the conclusion here that it does not.
I think we should ask John a question. What do you mean by sustainability?
I'm going to give the same answer.
You want to come up here and give the answer? But you have members saying do this.
Sustainability means the maximizing the assets available to pay the benefits as quickly as you can when there is an unfunded portion would be my first definition of sustainability. That's what I tried to ask her.
Do you think it's inappropriate to consider the salary and employment conditions of members in making decisions like this?
Inappropriate? No, you certainly should consider that.
So absolutely. Tell me how you would consider what the people who have come before you. One of them says, you know, we need you to ease the county's burden so we can increase our salaries. And the other one says, well, don't do it now because you're hurting us.
Our responsibility is to the plan and its members, not to their getting a salary increase, would be
all
my
plans.
Answer.
I'm sorry?
Not just to one plan. It's to all plans.
Plans?
Well, sponsoring plans, sponsoring agencies. We have a fiduciary responsibility to all of those agencies as well as the beneficiaries.
Jerry thinks we have a responsibility to the employers?
No.
We have a responsibility. They are sponsoring agencies.
Yes.
Our primary responsibility is to the beneficiaries. But
are there any beneficiaries, any members here who haven't showed up at the board meeting that you care about?
Yeah, I care about them all the members.
Well, the legacy members, the active members showed up. The Pepper members showed up.
Retirees haven't showed up.
Spoken like a good retiree. Thank you, Louis.
Jerry Tellis would have been right behind him.
As a retiree, what do you care?
Well, I care because I want to keep the system whole. By we shouldn't even be thinking as board members looking at the legacy members coming to us about pay raises. That's a negotiation that's something separate with the employer. We shouldn't even take that into consideration. We look at keeping the system whole by keeping the employer by taking the UAA out for 17 to 30 more years. What that does is help the employer pay the benefits that they're paying to the system, which keeps the system whole at that point in time and still pays down the unfunded liability.
Okay. Candace, should the board take into account this county's ability to pay?
Only to the extent that it impacts CSERA, the agency. Obviously, if we make a decision like we're going to lower rate of return to 4.5% and the county no longer has the ability to make their regular payments, yeah, then we have to balance that. But our primary primary fiduciary duty is to our beneficiaries and to the plan.
So what about the ability to, you know, we went through, many systems went through 9 years ago, furloughs. You know, because the county didn't have the money to, you know, they had to lay people off. That impacts the membership of the plan. Should that be taken into account? Should we be easing the plan sponsors' fiscal distress to avoid furloughs? You know, if you have a level percent of pay, if your unfunded liability is being amortized based on a level percent of county payroll, and county payroll shrinks, the contributions coming in shrink. Somebody want to take a swing at how that comes into play in terms of what's in the best interest of sustainability?
At the same time, assets dropped dramatically in your, looking back in history. I guess I would stay with the same concept. Our responsibility here is first to the plan and its ability to meet its obligations to its members before anything else. That doesn't mean you ignore everything else, but that's our basic responsibility.
Good. Anybody think there's another part of this? Rusty?
Again, it seems like in the first paragraph here, we're focusing on the employer's interest. They're concerned to be able to keep up with the level of service they're offering the public, at the same time having to deal with the high contributions that they're having to pay into the retirement system. And I'm sure, you know, are the board of supervisors represented here by appointed members, that might come to their mind. You know, it's something to consider when they're making the decision whether or not to go along with this proposal. And then in the second paragraph, again, we're dealing with the beneficiaries, all the members of the system here. But, you know, Paul has talked about this generational equity or inequity between members. And I'm all pro-equity, and I feel like, where we can, they should pay for those benefits current, now, and not pass it down to, some future generation to have to pay. Everybody should pay their fair share, basically. So as a fiduciary or member of the board here, I would want to disregard the second paragraph and again, on the first paragraph too, I would have to ignore it. I'd have to think about what's best for the system, keeping it solvent. And
I have one system client who invites the employer in when they're deciding where to set the assumed rate of return to see what the employer would like to have. How does that sound to you?
Doesn't sound good at all.
Wow.
14%.
Yeah.
One way to do it.
If I could add just a little corollary to that, I'm not compelled to take action if an employer were to come in and say, we don't think you should drop the rate of return from 7 to 6.75, mm-hmm. because that'll be a problem for us. But I dare say I might give some additional thought if this board, for instance, decided, you know, we no longer want to have a risk encumbered rate of return. So we're going to go from 7 to 2.25. I might be sitting there thinking,
going to buy an annuity.
Yes, right. So that to me would start bringing some pretty unusual factors into consideration about the impact on the sponsors. I understand they are not the beneficiaries, and there might be some support for that, but I might be hard pressed to vote for that kind of a change because that impact would be so disparate that it would be crippling.
You kill the goose when you're going after the golden eggs. Huh?
So in that case, haven't we leaned toward, to some degree at least, considering what the impact is going to be on the sponsoring agencies?
That's true. Right. Good point. Let's go to scenario 3.
Harvey, I was going to, one final just comment. You commented about future employees as something that we could have a responsibility for. I know under ERISA you're not allowed private plans to consider anyone who's not a member of the plan. Is there something in public plans that require you to think about that?
The nature of this defined benefit plan is that it is only sustainable if you take into account the cash flow that will and the benefits that will be coming from future employees. For example, PEPRA. When PEPRA came in, we had no PEPRA employees, right? In January 1 of 2013, there were no PEPRA employees. But the actuaries were spending a lot of time trying to figure out what was going to happen with the liabilities and the cash flow in the system. And we still continued level percent of pay, for example, on an anticipated payroll. You know that there will be members in the future. You know that they will be contributing into the system. You know that they will be earning benefits at certain levels. And so your obligation extends to those people, even though they're not in the system yet.
I believe all you actually look at, I'd be dumbfounded if it was something other than that, are the actual members. You're right, to the extent you have turnover. You assume that they're replaced by somebody else that is effectively the same for each valuation, and then of course you adjust annually as you produce new valuations. But they never get into the calculations that I know of.
The calculations of?
The valuation calculations.
Oh, well, that's correct. Yeah, no, not on the valuation. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Do we get the three? Let's try three. We have a bill pending in the legislature that would prohibit a retirement system from investing in any wholesaler or retailer that sells assault weapons anywhere in the United States. Governor of the state calls the chair of the county board of supervisors and says, I need your support for this bill. I want the county and all of its agencies to support the bill. It's so important to me that if you won't support the bill, we have some discretionary funding for your county schools. I will turn that off immediately. That goes on in politics all the time, right?
It actually does, yes.
Come on, you're not naive. Don't pull that naive stuff on. Yeah. So the supervisor quickly picks up the phone, calls the other three appointed members of the board for their support. You heard the Brown Act a few minutes ago. Think about this. Supervisor calls the other appointees for support. At the next board meeting, the supervisor enthusiastically moves to have the retirement board declare its support for the measure. There's a quick second, no discussion, unanimous vote in favor of the motion. Boom. Any fiduciary issues raised here?
Yes. And I'll take this.
Madam Supervisor?
Yes, exactly. I think this, of course, goes to the heart of what hat are you wearing when you walk in the store and when you represent Sosera. And clearly, it is a breach of the fiduciary duty to try to insist that this go forward when it may very well be to the detriment of the investments.
Well, the supervisor just made a motion.
Just made a motion, but nevertheless is asserting a position on behalf of the Board of Supervisors and on to benefit the county, not to benefit Sosera.
Does it bother you that there was no discussion about it?
Well, that goes without saying. Yeah, anytime you have a motion, there's no discussion. You get the Brown Act alert definitely starts blinking wildly. So that's the obvious.
Look at the motion here. Look at the motion here is to say we're not going to invest in assault weapons that are killing people. How controversial could that possibly be?
Now that's where you would need to bring in the expert as fiduciaries to say there's no reason you don't need to have assault weapons as part of your portfolio. In fact, it's better off for your beneficiaries if you don't have assault weapons, and there's a reasonable basis for it other than the governor saying he's not going to provide funding to the county.
If you were the supervisor caught in this, and I shouldn't pick on you, but
no, go ahead. I'm the only supervisor sitting here today.
Supervisor in this position, would you tell the board about the phone call from the governor?
If I were seriously going to assert this, but I would fully disclose why that would be coming forward, but I would also say we need to have an independent analysis of whether or not we should be doing this. If there's any, you know, if it's a neutral, maybe move forward, but you would have to have a full, robust discussion. And from my standpoint, you would need to hire an analyst or someone from within analyzing what would the implications of it be, so there would be full discussion.
You want to know what the impact on the fund is.
Right. If you were to suddenly divest of all assault weapons at the same time as the rest of the country is divesting of assault weapons. And would there be a negative impact? But nevertheless, it's to me, if I'm walking in, recommending we do this, not because I think it's in the best interest of the fund, but it's in the best interest of the county, it's a problem.
David.
Part of the problem is undue influence over the board. If the supervisor is only calling those appointed to the board and there's a majority on the board, then that's a problem. And so if there is going to be a discussion, then the supervisor should
bring this up. You've got a Brown Act violation.
Well, this is interesting. Undue influence. Is the supervisor in this scenario exercising undue influence over colleague board members?
If the supervisors are choosing the appointees to sit on the retirement board, then yes.
You agree with that one, Todd?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
Do you think if a supervisor in this position generally should not therefore communicate with other appointed members of the board? David's uncomfortable with that communication.
Communication is one thing, but calling them to say you have to vote this way, that's a different story.
That's the difference I would make, because, you know, she's then going to sit, you know, 3 years later at the most and, you know, look at Jerry and go, huh, that, or there's the potential she could look at Jerry, that was a big vote I really needed your support on and didn't get it, so, you know.
Well,
it's okay to have that feeling but not put the pressure on him at the time, is that?
It's one thing, I think, David, I totally agree. It's one thing to make an argument. It's another to then cross over to that, hey, I really need you to do this or else our schools are going to get hurt.
Are you bothered by the private conversations among board members?
It happens. You know, you can see it sometimes.
It's all hypothetical.
Well, I mean, not making decisions, but having conversations.
Uh-huh.
You know, as long as you don't have a quorum of the board.
How do you know?
Well, that's the risk you run.
I mean, suppose you got a supervisor and three appointees.
Mm-hmm.
When that conversation is going on,
mm-hmm.
How do we know that one of the appointees doesn't talk to one of the electeds?
You don't
know, and that's why Karen gave us that presentation.
Serial meetings.
I just attended a Brown Act educational seminar just recently,
yeah.
And this wasn't agendized, so they didn't put it on the agenda, and it sounds like they just asserted the question, called for the question, and then, so that's a Brown Act violation.
What wasn't
agendized? Well, it wasn't agendized. Oh. In your scenario? They just go to the next meeting and assert it.
Yeah.
Oh, this was.
Yeah. Well, and I also think about, too, the motion at hand is actually supporting a bill in the legislature, which we normally wouldn't do that unless there's a direct impact
to the plan.
And they're also not proposing that plan not invest in these types of things.
This is a wonderful point Gail raises, and let me make a quick distinction for you. There is an issue for public agencies, like a retirement board, as to whether or not you can weigh in on bills pending in the legislature, votes pending as initiatives or referendum before the people.
Hmm.
Now, actually, it is permissible to take a position and weigh in and even lobby for things that are in the legislature. Because that's the law was written, and the cases come down and say that's what we want agencies with knowledge and expertise to do. We want them to communicate with the legislature about bills pending. What you can't do is weigh in on and campaign for example, an initiative or a proposition that's on the public ballot. You can state a position in favor or against, but that's all you can do. You can't lobby, you can't use system assets and all that. Where you can do it in the legislature. So, but it's a great point for you to pick up on. because there are some real issues. Public agencies step over the line sometimes into lobbying activities when they support. But an expression of support by the board of a bill that's pending is perfectly fine. It's good. That's a great pickup there. So we have a scenario with things that don't feel right, behind the doors communications, undue influence being exercised, decisions being made at the board without due deliberation. This touches just about every one of those bullet points on the first slide in terms of your fiduciary responsibility. Let's go to scenario four. This is really a true story. Active county employee has just won election to her retirement board seat. The largest county union is throwing a cocktail party, private invitation-only cocktail party reception for the trustee, and they're going to include at that party her official swearing-in ceremony. All board members are invited to attend. Gail, or in this case the CEO, is very worried. Can the board attend? Can board members accept the value of what they're given at the reception? Is the value a gift to each board member? Do they have to disclose it as a gift? Is it subject to the gift limits? Should the CEO accept it on behalf of the system and then designate all the board members to attend? Should the system reimburse the union for the cost of the event? Let's start with this CEO. What do you think, Gail? Sort this out for us.
Okay. We didn't discuss this in advance. So.
No, we didn't.
So the public isn't invited to the event, so there definitely can't be a quorum of the board attending it. Just how when we talk about travel and training and how we can't have more than four trustees attend.
Let me stop you there. For purely social and ceremonial matters,
true.
They can.
True. Yeah.
Good. Okay. So take it further. So we have a private event, ceremonial.
But it's her official swearing in. So that's an official.
Okay. Work with me here. Come on.
There.
Wouldn't be appropriate to do that anyway.
No, I mean if it's just
so it's now official business.
If it's just simply a celebration,
uh-huh.
And they're inviting, you know. Invitation only, and they extend that to the board, but it's just a party. Then that's. But if it's official swearing in for her role,
yeah.
Then it's not simply private party. It's
then it's public.
Well, it should be public.
Ah.
Because it's a public office.
Interesting. Quizzical, Rusty?
Well, I'm just wondering if the swearing in has to be a public y'all come meeting. But if you decide just to have it among your staff only, and not open the event, not invite anybody else. Is that considered a private?
Well, the clerk of the county swears you in, right?
No.
Not necessarily.
That's not true.
Huh?
Christina did.
Christina swore.
So my first swearing in was, you know, in Christina's office, which you have to, you know, she had to scan me in or what have you. So
no, she was swearing at you.
Yeah,
that was swearing. That was different.
That usually happens after people know me.
That's
but anyway,
on, not swearing in.
Did that have to be open to the public?
No.
Well, I'm assuming it doesn't because it wasn't.
I wasn't invited.
There's no agenda.
So there's nothing. They're saying there's nothing about the swearing in that has to be public at a public meeting.
This strikes me as it could be just a very innocuous, come on over and have a glass of wine, watch the new board member be sworn in. It's under $42, I think that's our number.
It's up to 50 now.
It's now up to 50? Okay.
Okay, does that matter to you?
Well, it's not in the reportable gift environment at that point. You know, it's a glass of wine, maybe.
Okay.
Call it $5 or $10.
What kind of parties have you been going to?
Obviously lower level.
Christina didn't offer any wine. What the heck's
going on? How much are bologna sandwiches anyway, right?
But I can see this as not having any great significance to our current discussion. That it's a very innocuous.
You think this is totally okay, innocuous?
I think it can be defined that way. You know, I'm trying to put some numbers
good,
around.
No, that's good. You're giving some variables. So if it was caviar and Dom Perignon, that would take you in one direction.
If the Hilton across the street, that might be different. Yeah, it certainly would be to the extent that we're talking about valuations that are reportable.
Well, it's reportable, over $50, but it's cumulative, of course, for an entire year from the same source. So let's take it if it is over $50 a head. By the time they have to rent the room and the caterer and the whole thing, let's just graft onto the scenario. It's more than $50 a head now.
Easily, what? It's a union place. So come on, it's probably $300 a head. Wow.
So now what? Where does that take you?
Well, the pyramids would look bad because the union. You're going to have to claim the union as giving you that gift,
right? So is it a gift to each individual? Can the system accept the gift?
No.
Why not? It's a swearing in.
I wouldn't accept it.
Why?
Because we shouldn't be.
It just looks
or reimbursed. As opposed to the nuh-uh policy, so there's that.
I would too. Sorry, David, I wouldn't come.
I think the fundamental issue here is why did the retirement system... Why did the retirement system agree to have the swearing-in ceremony at this privately held event?
And have the union pay for it.
Yep. So it's all on you.
You missed the last part.
So you think that by grafting the official swearing-in on it, that's intended to bless it somehow as make it official business?
Yeah.
And by making it official business, where does that take you? The system can pay for it? Should the system, should we write a check and to the union for the cost?
No, they should have said that the swearing-in ceremony occurs elsewhere during business hours and not at this party.
Or to save money, they can just go to Christina's office.
Exactly. Or have the party in Christina's office.
And then you're separating out to Sarah and the official duties from whatever an external source would like to do in terms of parties.
So if we took the official part, if we took the swearing in out of it, and it was just a reception to congratulate the employee from being elected, can the system pay for it?
No.
Okay. All right. Good enough. Last one.
That would never happen here.
That would never
happen.
Also, except for the name Melissa, true story. Trustee Melissa works for a large retail investment firm. Melissa swears by index funds and ETFs. She's convinced that no active manager can ever beat the broad indexes over any reasonable length of time. Paying fees for active managers is simply wrong when you can do better with a 60-40 indexed passive portfolio. Set it and forget it is her motto. Melissa goes to no educational conferences. She doesn't read any materials on managers that respond to RFPs. She's got no interest in the consultant's capital market views. She votes against every decision about asset allocation other than investing in the Russell 3000 and the Barclays aggregate. Is she breaching her fiduciary duty? Is she just one wonderfully refreshing trustee?
Are we going to give Tim equal time here?
Pretty much destroys the prudent expert standard.
What do you think?
She doesn't meet the definition of a prudent expert.
She's a knowledgeable person in the field. She's tested these things in her private business affairs. She knows all about this. She's come to a conclusion based upon years of experience, Jerry. How can you say she's not a prudent expert?
I have garnered all this in a long history of my life that opinions don't represent knowledge and expertise. They just represent opinions.
Well, suppose she did have, she came to this, that she's got an economics degree from McGill University. She's got, she went to the Wharton School. She's a graduate from the London School of Economics. She's a Fed governor. She's got the cred.
Well, you changed the scenario now.
Oh, I know, but does that matter?
She still isn't diversifying. And that's
she still believes in diversification. What do you think? Tannis doesn't
ETF
like
by definition. Could be well diversified.
Quite as much.
I can tell you the Wall Street Journal has articles once a week on exactly this, and right. It is a legitimate position, mm-hmm. reasonably.
Okay.
Written by Melissa.
It is not outside of a reasonable, in my sense, reasonable range of opinions. She's obviously in one side of it, but there's a whole school of thought that believes exactly this.
So let me ask this question. If she's getting her education from the Wall Street Journal and other sources, does she still have to do all the educational stuff that we do as trustees, yep. or is that okay?
Is it required by law?
Huh?
Is it required by law?
Yeah.
Well, if it's required by law, she should.
She should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the requirement is to have X number of educational hours.
Right.
Are we assuming that she hasn't met those? That she hasn't?
I don't know. Can you meet those? Do you have to go to the board-sanctioned conferences to get that? It's like homeschooling compared to public schools, right? Melissa is homeschooled. What's wrong with that? Isn't that being prudent?
Has to be certified.
Has to be certified.
Yeah.
Okay, but that you're so it's technical.
I'm unclear on one thing. You haven't suggested. I mean, you suggested here she's an investment firm uh-huh. representative.
Yeah.
But later on, you said she votes. Is that just a?
Oh, she's a trustee.
She's a trustee.
Board. Trustee Melissa.
Melissa. Oh, I missed that part.
That wasn't trustee Melissa.
Trustee Melissa.
Trustee Melissa.
E-E, not Y. Okay, I thought it was a typo.
Harvey, do we know her firm, who they market themselves to, what type of clients?
Well, I took that out of because I didn't want you to go off on that on the tangent that her firm markets to public pension
funds.
Okay,
so we'll move on from
that
then.
So, but if they did, if her firm marketed to public pension funds, where would that take you, Gail?
She shouldn't be on the board.
Yeah, she shouldn't be on the board. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Never been appointed.
And I'm assuming that in this scenario,
so I had to take that out to make her a trustee.
That she would have been an appointed trustee, which makes it hard to imagine that she would have ever gotten past the...
Not past me, no.
The board appointees.
Oh, I don't know about that. What do you think about that, Jay?
Yeah, that's a tough one.
I don't mean Contra Costa.
I know what you mean. that's kind of the question here. If she was, educated to the extent like she had a PhD, a doctorate in economics, if she was somehow a former Fed chair that wanted to volunteer here, versus, you know, maybe she was the marketing person at an index provider or so, who makes the determination as to whether her opinions are kind of, you know, the opinions of an expert? Are the other trustees supposed to kind of evaluate the basis for her market views?
No, that is a great question, because it comes to the issue of collective decision making. The legislature created this board and boards like this unlike the New York State Comptroller who controls that pension fund, is a single person. This is crafted as a collective decision making, and so the issue really is about process. And you know, why should you, even more broadly, why should you listen to any one of your colleagues on any issue? Some are employees, they have a lot of knowledge about employment issues. Some are appointed or come from the investment world, such as yourself, and you know, but you develop a credibility based upon the ability to support your positions over time, and you get to learn to trust each other and make, but the obligation is for the board to act and make a collective judgment on things. And the prudence standard asks not what your ultimate decision is, but what process did you go through to get to that decision? And that's probably the biggest issue with Trustee Melissa. She refuses to go through the process that the board goes through in making a prudent decision. When you look at the cases that have come down, and some very recent ones, both in public, mostly in ERISA plans, for example, the issue is not, you know, did the trustees try to catch a falling knife when the stock of General Motors was going down, and did they do it in time, or they shouldn't have done it, or they shouldn't have loaded up the GM pension plan with GM stock knowing that it was tanking. The question is, did the trustees go through a prudent process of trying to figure out what was in the best interest of the members and the plan? If they went through that process, they're not violating their fiduciary duty. If they didn't go through that process, they're violating their fiduciary duty. So it's all about the collective process that you go through. That's a great, great trigger point there is, you know, why should we trust each other? Why should we listen to a Melissa? Well, you have to test each other, and you have to test it through this process that we go through. So great point.
Harvey, is there another issue here? Let's say Melissa had engaged in the process. She was sharing opinions formed elsewhere with the trustees, but in a single-minded way, and ignoring every single attribute of the plan that she was a trustee for. Is that a breach of fiduciary responsibility?
Probably, so, but you'd have to prove that right. She was ignoring that. It's tough. We all come to these board meetings bringing the pros and cons of the baggage that we bring to the table.
Yeah.
And then you have to say, well, some of that I have to check at the door. Some of that it's okay for me to bring into the conversation.
No, but technical trustee requirement for open ears.
No open ears requirement. Yeah.
I was going to say she would have a lot more credibility in her opinion and her vote if she went to these conferences and reviewed the RFPs. And the RFPs, to put those out there, that was voted on by the board.
Right.
Right. And so that's a board action or a board function. So even if she didn't want to go that route,
right,
the board voted to do it.
The board
so
voted to do it.
She still has an obligation to go through that. And if she, after went through all the education and reviewed the RFP, then said, I've done all the research and so forth, I still feel this way.
Yeah.
60-40, then that would be a different story.
And the other thing that you could do, you're absolutely right, but say when the managers come and present at the RFPs or however the process works, she should take this knowledge that she has and challenge them with it and say, show me where you've beaten the market over a sustained period of time, because she could make her point better that way than simply saying, hell no, set it and forget it, I don't care about it. So, well done. Live situations haven't been confronted here, but I wanted to give you some thoughtful opportunity to take the theory and apply it in practice. Any questions about any of this? I think we can wrap it up here, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you, Harvey.
And we're flunking the three guys who signed off from Tory. They don't get their credits.
That's funny.